hello to all of our guests and audience. Welcome and thank you for joining us. My name's Sam Byers. I'm here today with Matt Koenig and Dan Negrea to talk about their new book, We Win, They Lose, Republican Foreign Policy and the New Cold War. The book articulates a comprehensive strategy for conservative U.S. foreign policy based on the Trump-Reagan fusion position and designed to position the United States for victory in a new Cold War against the People's Republic of China and its fellow authoritarian regimes, Russia, Iran, and North Korea. I'm excited to have both the book's authors with us today to talk about the foreign policy consensus they see emerging on the American right. By way of introduction, we have with us Dr. Matthew Koenig, who's the Vice President and Senior Director of the Atlantic Council's Scowcroft Center for Security and Strategy, as well as a professor of government at Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. We also are delighted to have Dan Negrea, who's the Senior Director of the Atlantic Council's Freedom and Prosperity Center. And during the Trump administration, Dan served in the State Department as the Special Representative for Commercial and Business Affairs and on the Policy Planning Office staff. Matt, Dan, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Really great to be here. And Vandenberg's such a terrific organization. So extra special to be speaking with you and the others today.
Oh, thank you. It's a delight to have you with us. And for our audience, do keep in mind questions and things that come up during the talk. I'll save some time at the end and ask some audience questions, so be ready to put those in the chat. So Dan and Matt, to start out, I wanted to kind of start at the beginning of the book. And in the preface, there's a story that you relate about how the idea for this book came about. And I'd love if one of you could tell it to us here, both because I think it's a fun, you know, little vignette. And also, I think it gets to the heart of how there's a debate going on in the conservative foreign policy conservative foreign policy community at the moment. And that's the debate that you're trying to address here.
Sure. Well, I'll start with that story. And before I do that, though, just a brief disclaimer. Dan and I are at the Atlantic Council. I have the Atlantic Council banner behind me there. But the Atlantic Council is a nonpartisan organization. And so this is a somewhat partisan book. And so the thoughts in the book are my thoughts and Dan's thoughts, not the views of the Atlantic Council as an organization. But yeah, so the I think the origins of the book are about 3 years ago. We were at a foreign policy retreat on the future of Republican foreign policy, or the sister organization to Vandenberg that you probably know. And you know, there were former Trump administration officials, former officials from other administrations, including Never Trumpers, kind of a big tent gathering. And what stood out to me and many others, I think, is that basically there was a lot of agreement. We agreed on the major issues. And at one point, a prominent U.S. senator said, really what we need is a Trump-Reagan fusion. And we thought that was an interesting idea and one that we wanted to explore. And actually, in doing the researching and writing of this book, we came to the conclusion that the party is more united than many people believe. And there is this perception, I think, that the party is deeply divided. You have the kind of Reaganites on one hand who are internationalists. They believe in free trade. On the other hand, you have the Trumpian wing. It's protectionist. It's isolationist. And we essentially came to the conclusion that that's not really the case. And so in the book, we start basically with political philosophy. What does it mean to be a conservative? What does it mean to be a progressive? How does that lead to different views in foreign policy? And we think the Reaganites and the Trumpians are aligned there. They're conservative in their worldview. And when it comes to defense, the party believes in peace through strength. When it comes to economic policy, I think the party believes in free and fair trade, both wings. They believe in American exceptionalism. And then if you go through specific issues, China, NATO, climate, border, again, I think there's a lot of agreement. So this idea of a Trump-Reagan fusion, bringing the various wings of the party together and one unifying vision to unite them is what we try to provide in this book.
Excellent. Dan, I was wondering if you could dive into that a little bit more. You know, what's the Trump-Reagan fusion? What are the key elements for you? And Why these two presidents? What makes them unique? And maybe what makes them a little different from each other, even if there are similarities?
Yeah, so why these two presidents? Because they are most certainly the most influential Republican presidents in a generation. And because the moment in time in which we are today resembles in so many respects the moment in which Reagan was president. And we find, I mean, if you look at the title of the book, it is We Win, They Lose. And then the subtitle is Republican Foreign Policy and the New Cold War. We had the Cold War that was won under when Reagan was president. We argue in our book that we are again in a Cold War, that we will need to recognize and prosecute under President Trump. And we also believe that just as in the days of Reagan, there was the Soviet Union and the satellite states that were adversarial regimes arraigned against the United States. Similarly, today we have something that we call the new axis of evil, Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea, that are not in a formal alliance the way the Soviet Union and the Comecon Warsaw Pact countries were. But they are similarly to the situation in the first Cold War, in the sense that they have a common ideology, which is authoritarianism, and the determination to create a world safe for autocracy and oppose the world that the United States created after the Second World War, where the central element is freedom.
So one of the things that I, you know, I enjoyed reading the book, and one of the things that stood out to me is, unlike a lot of policy books, you start out with philosophy and some moral psychology. And Matt, you just mentioned a little bit of that there, and how progressives think about things differently than conservatives. And you get down into the weeds and, you know, on the philosophical level. So could you expand on that a little more and tell us, what do you see are the critical differences between how progressives view the world and how conservatives view the world, and how that manifests in your foreign policy elites and in the foreign policy that you your country eventually pursues?
Yes, and I don't want you to scare potential readers off, because it's not too dense, and we tried to keep it readable. But this was one of the things that was most interesting to me, because if we're going to write a book on conservative foreign policy, then what does it mean to have a conservative foreign policy? What does it mean to have a progressive foreign policy? And in fact, a book editor we talked to early in the process said, I don't really see the value in this book. I don't think there's really any difference. You know, the Republicans and Democrats, they have the same foreign policy. And so we wanted to grapple with that. And, you know, this is something I wish I could have read 20 or so years ago as a student, someone laying this out, but it didn't really exist as far as I could tell. So Dan and I went back to basics and consulted political scientists like Sam Huntington, who described what it means to be a conservative. We went to Jonathan Haidt, a social psychologist who described the moral differences between conservatives and progressives. And then starting there, then we built up, if you believe these things, then what does it mean for what you want your government to do in world affairs? And then how does it lead to these consistent differences between Republicans and Democrats on issues like international institutions, the value of American power? And so essentially we argue that conservatives, some of their core beliefs are that the world is dangerous and that there is value to protecting your in-group. And then if that's the case, then the primary way you see the U.S. government is to advance American interest in a dangerous world. So it is putting America first. Whereas progressives have a political philosophy more formed by the European Enlightenment. They believe that past misunderstandings and failures of the human condition were the result of a lack of science, a lack of understanding, and that if only we can apply reason, apply good government policies, we can ameliorate the human condition. So I think progressives often see U.S. foreign policy as the priority should be working with other nations to solve shared global challenges. And so that's where we start. And that is another place where the parties united. I think both Reaganites and Trumpians begin with that more conservative worldview, not the more progressive view of America's role in the world.
Could either of you give us, maybe one or two key examples that illustrate that in the foreign policy domain? Like, what are real, the policy debates that most draw out this distinction? And if the philosophical debate and division is so deep between progressives and conservatives, does that mean that we're unlikely to see any bipartisan foreign policy consensus in the future that we maybe have had in the past 30 or 50 years?
So let me give you two examples of where this difference is very clear. So one, looking to, let me start with your second question, which is very interesting. Make sure that I don't forget it, which is this. We can think about foreign policy options and debate them, and there will be differences between parties until we get to a point, and I hope we don't get to that point, where there is a grave crisis, at which point there are realities that impose themselves, and whether it's Republicans or Democrats in power, those realities will force decisions that will bring to the fore fundamental geostrategic realities that affect the United States that are not optional, say in the case of a war, for example. Then it's very clear we have to win that war, and pray God we don't get to that situation. But until then, we can see the progressive worldview very clearly in how today the Biden administration is looking at relations with China. Relations with China are defined as most recently as being a combination of competition, cooperation, and confrontation. Well, in the book, we say they're only one third right. They're right about the confrontation part. It is not a competition when one of the competitors is not respecting any rules, the way China is not respecting in rules, whether it is the rules and customs of international trade, where they lie, cheat, and steal. They are not respecting the norms in the Charter of the United Nations, where there was, for example, in their dispute with the Philippines, a decision of the International Court of Justice, but they are not respecting. And they are supporting Russia, which violated Article 1 of non-aggression, and on and on and on. So, but the reason why the Biden administration is going in that direction is because there is this hope, this aspiration of resolving anything in conversations, in discussions, in trying to convince the other side. The other example would be international institutions. The progressives talk about the community of nations. At the beginning of the Trump administration, there was an article written by General McMaster and Cohen, who was chief of the Council of Economic Advisers, saying there is no community of nations. There is an arena in which nations compete for their national interest, essentially the America First idea. There are all kinds of nations that are pursuing policies that are not admirable. And yet at the United Nations, they have a vote just like Switzerland and Canada and the United States have a vote. So these would be some examples of how different worldviews between progressives and conservatives are resulting in different policies and different approach to policy.
In a way, you can kind of describe it as a, you know, a referee mindset in some ways, where you have, you know, a certain group of leaders, and it's, you know, maybe on the left predominantly, but there are also, you know, some on the right who think of our job as to manage things rather than to win. And obviously, with the title of the book being "They Win" or "We Win, They Lose," you seem to think, and I think you would both agree, that winning is important, is a goal that we should pursue. What does winning look like in the next, 10, 15, 20 years going forward in this new Cold War? And how do we break out of that referee mindset? How do we stop thinking in terms of, oh, we should just manage everything and make sure it stays okay? No, we want to actually move forward and win and achieve concrete and clear goals.
Yes, well, so first on the title, and for those who aren't familiar, this was the famous Ronald Reagan quote about the first Cold War. He was asked, what is your goal for managing the Soviet Union? And he said, well, it's simple. Some might say it's simplistic, but it's this. It's we win and they lose. And he was shortly thereafter elected, pursued that clear strategic vision, and by the end of his two terms in office, had succeeded in winning the first Cold War. Now we're in a second Cold War, more dangerous than the first. The Trump administration really announced this to the world in their 2017 national security strategy, declaring great power competition the foremost priority of the United States. But competition isn't a strategy. What's the goal? And it's been a hobby of ours the past couple of years, asking senior officials, what is the goal of our China strategy? And we haven't gotten very many clear answers. And so we propose a clear answer in this book, which is it's, again, we win, they lose. And by that, we mean that China no longer has the ability to threaten core interests, either that they lack the ability to do that because we've strengthened ourselves so much, constrained them so much, or that they essentially change their minds and that they lack the will to threaten U.S. vital interests. And we're very forward to and kind of explain what that might look like, and I can go into more detail if you're interested. But we were very fortunate to have a forward from Mike Pompeo, former Secretary of State, and he improved on our language because we have this long, complicated explanation of what it means to win. And he has one sentence that says, winning is when the Chinese Communist Party or either it's capitulation or it's incapacitation. And so I think that's what we mean. It's capitulation or it's incapacitation. Oh, and I think you're on mute, Sam.
Thank you. I think that's a good, clear, and straightforward goal, and obviously similar to what we were trying to do with the Soviet Union during the Cold War. And you guys obviously directly draw the comparison from the Cold War to a new Cold War today. But I think as you dig into the analogy, you start to see, and a lot of people have written about this, how China is both a larger threat to the United States and also a qualitatively different threat in terms of the challenges it poses from a grand strategy foreign policy perspective. So my question for you, perhaps, Dan, is, what are the, you've drawn this comparison, but what are the differences between the Soviet Union, original Cold War, and the competition with China in this new Cold War? What are the differences we need to be aware of, and how does that change the strategy that you you both lay out in the book? How does that affect the tools that are at our disposal and the different courses of action we should try to pursue?
So the difference that is most often mentioned between the first Cold War and the second is the closeness of the economic relations between China today and the United States. As a matter of fact, in one of the most recent of the quite a few Biden foreign policy doctrines, it is defined as follows: strategic competition in conditions of interdependence. So a lot of is being made out of this interdependence, economic interdependence between the United States and China. We address this in the book, but I would like to go a little bit further. So what we have in the book is the following, that there are three categories of economic relations with the People's Republic of China. One are relations in the in areas that are sensitive from a national security point of view, and there the selective decoupling needs to be executed as soon as possible. So, for example, it is unacceptable to depend on the Chinese for 90% of our antibiotics. It's unacceptable to depend on them on artillery shells components. On the 155, apparently we depend on them on some of those components and things of this sort. Then there are other economic relations that are not extremely sensitive from the point of view of national security, but areas in which the Chinese are cheating. And we need to deal with those with tariffs and other means. And then there are things like we sell them soybeans and we buy t-shirts from them, and those can continue. But the point, so we address this in the book, but the point I would like to make to go further is a lot of people are doubtful that decoupling, selective decoupling or de-risking can be done or can be done quickly. It is already happening. And it is not just the United States identifying these areas. The Chinese are identifying exactly the same areas, especially the national security issues. And if you look at the policies outlined in Made in China 2025, they were very, very clear that they want to reduce their dependence on Western companies on things that they consider important. And for national security reasons, and also for promoting Chinese companies, they want to help their companies become global leaders and move away from trade and dependence on Western companies. So the decoupling is occurring from both sides. So what we many consider today interdependence with China, it is going away naturally anyway.
I completely agree, as always with Dan. If I could just add one point,
please.
You know, some people say, well, it's not a Cold War because it's not exactly like the first Cold War. Well, World War II wasn't exactly like World War I, but they were both world wars. Similarly here, I think these are both Cold Wars, and the similarities are more striking than the differences.
So another area of difference, Dan did a great job of drawing out kind of how there's the qualitative difference on the economic angle, whereas maybe the Cold War, the first Cold War, was more of a military competition. But another difference, of course, is the geography. And first Cold War was very much centered on Europe, but spilled over into other regions of the world, other regions of Eurasia in particular. And now we're looking at a competition centered on Asia and, you know, a great power in Asia. And that sparked a really big debate, especially in the conservative and the Republican foreign policy community, kind of between the Asia first, but not only camp and the all in on Asia camp. You know, how should we divide our resources? How should we prioritize between competing with China, but also with Russia, Iran, or other adversaries around the world? Where do we put our eggs between the different baskets? Where do you stand on this debate? And how does your book explore this tension between how to take limited resources and apply them to a variety of threats of varying degrees of importance?
Yes, what we argue in the book is that the party is, you're right that there's a lively debate on Twitter, but our argument is that actually the party is more united on this. And it's an Asia first, but not only approach. So China is the biggest threat facing the United States, and that's what we argue in the book. But the China threat is a global one. It's not just about defending the beaches of Taiwan. It's about countering China's growing influence everywhere. And moreover, as we point out, China is increasingly working with this axis of revisionist autocracies, Russia, Iran, North Korea. And so countering China also means countering their allies in Russia, Iran, and North Korea. Moreover, just in practice, it's not, if you really wanted to put in a pure Asia first policy, it's not even clear to me how that would work. Are we going to take all the tanks in Europe and move them to Japan? I think it is prioritize China, but we still have global interest and need to be a global power. And then how to do that? On the defense side, we essentially make three recommendations. One, the United States increasing its defense spending. We're at historic lows in terms of defense spending as a percent of GDP. So I think this is one difference between the Republican Party that believes in peace through strength and the other side, where we're essentially seeing cuts to the defense budget after inflation. Second, the allies need to do more, and Trump is right about this. And it's not just about fairness. It's about having the capabilities to deal with all of these adversaries. The United States can't do it all on its own. And then third, it's like during the first Cold War, relying more on nuclear deterrence. And the Biden administration has said that they want to reduce reliance on nuclear weapons. I think that's wrong. We need to be increasing reliance on nuclear weapons. And I'm currently serving as a commissioner on a congressional commission on strategic posture. We just delivered our recommendations to Congress in October. Bipartisan commission, 6 Democrats, 6 Republicans, and we essentially recommend that we begin planning the first strategic arms buildup since the end of the Cold War, that we plan to put additional nuclear weapons in theaters in Europe and Asia. So I think we, Asia first, but not only, and that's how we do it.
So you guys in the book, you do a kind of around the world of China, Russia, Iran, or other adversaries and how to tackle each of them in turn. But then at the end, you dig into some of the non-traditional challenges and in national security. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about those. Some of them, I think, animate the right a little more, and some animate the left a little more. Border security, maybe in the former category, international institutions, climate in the latter category. So my question is, you know, how should we think about these sets of non-traditional or kind of non-state-on-state security challenges in the context of the new Cold War, and how have they changed since the original Cold War? Obviously, you know, we had border problems in the 70s and 80s, and you know, amnesty under Reagan and things like that, and the international institutions we're living with date largely to the post-World War II era. We had, you know, energy as a perennial issue. So these are not new things, but how have they changed, and how should we think of them in the context of competition with China?
So Sam, I like very much how you phrased the question. I really do. Actually, we just came from a panel discussion, Matt and I, and this is exactly how we've framed it, which is, if you accept the premise that we are in a Cold War, then there are policy choices that look very, very different than if you don't believe that you are in a Cold War. So if you look at the border situation, for example, can anyone imagine a situation where during the first Cold War there will be an undefined number of Soviet citizens of military age entering the United States without us knowing where they are, where they are going? There were people who asked for political asylum. I was one of them. There were very few who made it out, and they were carefully vetted. But we have a situation on the border today where the number of Chinese citizens of military age that were encountered at our southern border increased from 450 in 2021 the first Biden administration year, to 24,000 last year. It's an extraordinary number. And these are encounters. And if you ask the Border Patrol how many of these people were actually allowed to enter the United States, you can't get a precise number. Similarly with the number, so this affects one of the countries in the axis of evil. Another country on the axis that is a member of the axis of evil is Iran, the world's largest state sponsor of terrorism. Now, there were in the first 3 years of the Trump administration before COVID started, there were 11 people who are on the terrorist watch list encountered at the southern border. Last year, there were 170. Look what happened in Israel. There was a massacre on October 7 by terrorists. Look at what happened in Moscow. There was a massacre caused by terrorists. It's an unacceptable risk to allow a large, and then there are 1.6 million of known gotaways, meaning people who chose not to talk to the Border Patrol and entered the United States. These are unacceptable risks if we are in a Cold War situation. The same thing with energy. According to the Biden administration, the existential risk to the United States is climate change. We argue in the book and we show based on reports produced by the Biden administration that it is not an existential risk. It's a problem to be managed. But then because of the Biden administration's view on climate, they're making decisions regarding our fossil fuel, I mean, oil and gas particularly, industries that are reducing our national security strength. And again, if we believe that we are in a Cold War, which we believe that we are, then, for example, we need to have the capability to export LNG, and the Biden administration right now is countering that.
Excellent. Well, I'm noticing we're getting, you know, about halfway through. So I'm going to ask one more question and then I'll turn it over to the audience and I'll ask a few from our audience members. So that's your flag to everyone listening in. You'll find in the menu, you can type a question and it'll pop up here on the side and I'll pick a few and read them off to Matt and Dan. So now's your chance to get your questions in. I'm going to ask you one last question and maybe a quasi political question. You know, this book, you know, as we've been talking about, it's about Reagan and Trump and kind of the Trump-Reagan fusion. And both of these presidents are people who came in sort of as outsiders in the Republican party and challenging the status quo in the, you know, conservative foreign policy community. But as of this moment, you know, Donald Trump is the presumptive GOP nominee for, you know, re-election in 2024, you know, up against Joe Biden. How would his re-election change the balance, do you think, between the Trump and the Reagan strains of the emerging foreign policy consensus that you chart in this book? Do you think it would weight the scales more towards a Trump approach, or do you think it would have, you know, you'd stay the same course? They're really, you know, the two of them are actually really similar, and Trump being reelected, you'd still have the same course, or would it shift it in one direction or another?
I think the argument of our book is that this idea that the party is deeply divided between these two different wings is essentially incorrect, that we actually agree on a lot. And so I think that, you know, the Trump-Reagan fusion is what Trump would essentially follow. And we point out in the book that Trump and Reagan were more alike than maybe people understand. You know, one, just in terms of their backgrounds, they were both Democrats before they became Republicans. They were both entertainers before they became politicians. They were both castigated as reckless and dangerous, and yet they became the most influential Republican presidents of their generation. Or of of the past several decades. And then, you know, just one good example, you know, I think we constantly hear that Reagan was a free trader. Trump is a protectionist. We point out in the book that their approach to trade is actually pretty similar. People misremember Reagan. He used tariffs against friends and allies, including the European Common Market and Japan, to get better trade deals for the American people, got Japan to curtail some of its market distorting practices through tariffs. And then similarly with Trump's not protectionist for his own sake. He's been very clear that this is a tool to get freer and fairer trade deals. He did that with Korea, did that with Canada and Mexico. And we have some quotes in the book, his tweets against the European Union. He said, okay, I'm the protectionist. How about we drop all tariffs, all barriers? That's free and fair trade. And the Europeans said, oh no, of course we can't do that. Again, I think Reagan and Trump have a lot in common, and maybe what it is that they're different from maybe what the bipartisan kind of view was in the 1990s, early 2000s. So maybe it's a return to kind of what republicanism used to be to some degree.
Dan, any thoughts from you on this line?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that there is a Reagan wing. I think there are many senators and many members in the House that have different points of view. So, for example, Rand Paul, I don't know in what category to put him. I mean, I guess you can put him as a libertarian, doesn't like foreign involvement pretty much anywhere. But I don't know that I would put him in either the Reagan category or the Trump category. And then you have Lindsey Graham. He's very close to President Trump, but he is a hawk. And he is, the caricature of Senator Graham, whom I like very, very much, by the way, is that he's never seen a conflict that he wouldn't like the United States to send troops into. As we point out in the book, Reagan didn't get us into any wars. Trump didn't get us into any wars. They don't like that instinctively. Then you have J.D. Vance. And J.D. Vance is saying, well, I don't think we should send weapons to Ukraine. But the argument that he makes is not that we shouldn't get involved, period, but rather we are running out of stuff for ourselves, and he's not confident that under President Biden, we are rebuilding our industrial defense base rapidly enough. But again, I wouldn't know in what category to put him. In the House, it's easy to sort of identify a Trump wing. So I would say, where I would come out on your question, Sam, is as follows. If President Trump comes back in a second term, as polls may seem to indicate right now, he's a very strong leader. I don't think we are going to see a Reagan wing and a Trump wing. The Republican Party is now Trump's party, has been remade from a country club elite type of heavily in that direction, very much a blue collar Republican Party. And I think there will be one party and there will be nuances around the president's policy in the second term.
All right. So moving to a couple questions from our audience, and please feel free to continue sending those in. One first question, kind of pointing out another difference between the Cold War challenge and the present challenge with China is the relative economic position of our adversary and their ability to sustain a military and a strategic buildup. And of course, that was a major hallmark of the Reagan administration, was military buildup to put the Soviets on the back foot, that they couldn't sustain economically. Whereas it seems like the shoe's on the other foot when we look at competition with China, where perhaps, you know, Matt, you had mentioned, you know, we need to raise our defense budget above this historic low, but we're facing difficulties, you know, even building out the supply chain to support relatively minor or small in the grand scheme of things to support military operations for Ukraine. We don't have the defense industrial base we did 40 years ago. So generally the question is, you know, how should we approach that challenge? What concessions do we need to make, or what adaptations do we need to make, recognizing that we're not in the same industrial or economic position necessarily that we were 40 years ago? And how does that change our strategy?
You want me to go first, Dan, or do you want
to? Oh, please. Yes, definitely.
Yeah, so I'd say a couple things. One, the United States still is in the, yes, it's true that China is more capable than the Soviet Union was, but the United States is still in the stronger position. So international relations scholars often use percent of GDP as a good measure of power. US is still 25% of global GDP. That's where we were in the 1960s. So people who say the United States is declining are incorrect. We're right where we've always been. China is only about 18% of global GDP. So if it is just the United States and China, who can outspend whom, we're in the stronger position. Moreover, look at our systems. And this is a similarity with the first Cold War. Reagan believed that our free market system could outcompete a totalitarian system. And similarly, we see under China that Xi Jinping is essentially killing the goose that laid the golden egg. And by renationalizing parts of the Chinese economy, reasserting Communist Party control, killing off Chinese growth, the reported numbers are pretty low. And the real numbers are lower than that because the Chinese lie about their numbers. So if it's just us against them, we're in the stronger position. Fortunately, it's not just us against them. We have 32 or more formal treaty allies. Combined, we have something like 60% of global GDP. So I don't think this is about underlying economic capacity. It is about will, which gets us back to Dan's previous point and to the title of the book. You know, what we've been talking about this for a while now. We're in a new Cold War. It's time to act with some urgency. Let's increase defense spending. Let's revitalize the defense industrial base. Let's, like Trump is, encourage the allies to do more, because we're entering a new, more dangerous period, and we're not quite ready.
Dan, did you have any thoughts?
I always have thoughts, but I'm always nervous to add to what Matt says, especially on military matters. So,
well, in that case, I'll.
Here is a couple of things I would like to. Let me emphasize the point that Matt made about clarity of purpose. That is what is really needed, and political will. Russia has an economy the size of Italy, and yet they are viewed as a formidable threat to Europe. The reason being that Europe is not even at the 2% level that they had agreed that they want to be. At the conference in Wales in 2014, after the first invasion of Ukraine. And while they are talking about, at the Vilnius conference of NATO, about 2% being the floor rather than the ceiling, and promising to, I've been discussing and aspiring to increase their spending, they are not doing as much as they can if they had political will. They would have to take from social spending and give to military spending. Matt and I wrote an article arguing that the new level for Europe, the Europeans, should be 3%. Poland is at 4%. Israel, for example, is at 4.5%. Countries that are in critically important national security threat situations are capable and should increase their defense spending. And then when it's a matter of the United States versus China, we are at something like 800 million, and they are at 250. But they are increasing their spending, and they are at something like 7%. So it's a matter of political will and not of capacity.
So a second question from our audience. This questioner is asking about if you see a difference between the type of wins that both Trump and Reagan pursued, and kind of contending that Reagan's wins were part of a broader vision of freedom agenda, kind of looking out towards the whole world, and Reagan pursued wins to those ends, whereas as Trump's vision was perhaps he wanted to win, but in a more transactional way. Do you see that, in your process of researching this book? And I'll add, perhaps if there are other areas where you do see clear differences between the styles of the two, the two philosophies that you, are putting forward as part of this fusion, that would be interesting to hear about.
So let me start first. So I think a lot is being made by what some people see less emphasis that President Trump put on allies, while under President Reagan, clearly he viewed himself as the leader of the free world. I'm not sure I agree with that, and I think what we are arguing in the book in several places is that President Trump recognizes the value of allies and actually has contributed tremendously to encouraging allies to do more and gave them political cover to do more. And let me elaborate on that. He was very vocal and very public in his demands that the European NATO allies do more. Stoltenberg, the Secretary General of NATO, thanked him in an article. And a lot of people said, how can he talk to allies like this? Well, they were not doing what they had promised to do. They were not doing enough for their own self-defense, what was their interest. And by the way, also the interest of the United States. And if I can quote J.D. Vance on here, he had a great line. He says, any amount that the European NATO allies are not contributing as promised, and the United States is carrying a burden that it shouldn't carry, is a tax on American taxpayers. It's a tax that we are paying. And countries that are not carrying their weight are not allies, but are clients. But what the result, and Stoltenberg pointed to it in this Wall Street Journal article, was that the result of the hectoring from President Trump, the European NATO allies increased their NATO contribution by something like $400 billion. That's a great thing to strengthen the alliance. So I don't agree with the general view that President Trump is for America alone. It's for America first. America values allies. For example, the relationship with Japan was excellent, with Australia was excellent. It was the European allies that he pushed to do more.
And I would just add, of course, Reagan and Trump are not the same people. There are differences, and I think a lot of people have picked up on that. And so we obviously agree there are differences, but I think the kind of novel argument in the book is that actually on policy, the party's more united than people understand, and that actually Reagan and Trump were more alike than many people appreciate.
Excellent. Well, I know we have a hard out right at the end of the hour, so I'll ask one more from our audience as we wrap up, and you can add any final thoughts as well. This last question is about the concept of peace through strength and how it ultimately implies that we have a willingness to use military power either directly or indirectly as needed, where it advances our interests. And so the question is, how should the next Republican administration helped to bring the war in Ukraine to an end, a long-term solution to Israel of Gaza, prevent China's invasion of Taiwan, and also deal with the negative trends in places like Latin America and our own backyard with Venezuela, Nicaragua, et cetera. And, you know, our adversaries, involvement in the Western Hemisphere. The next Republican administration, how should the president and you know, other senior officials approach these challenges and use American power to advance American interests?
Just provide a brief strategy for saving the world in 90
seconds. You can take it any direction you'd like.
Yeah, a couple points I'd like to hit. One, peace through strength, I think, is where the party is on defense and security. And this means that the United States is so strong that adversaries don't challenge us. But that when we are challenged, we need to be willing to hit back, just like Reagan, sunk Iranian naval vessels after they attacked the United States assets in the region. And just like Trump was willing to hit back against General Soleimani after killed an American contractor. But the peace part is also important. I think both Reagan and Trump and the party today are skeptical of amorphous military interventions with no clear end in sight. And so I think that's where the party is. And it's different from maybe where the party was two decades ago. And I think also different from where the Biden administration and Democrats are, where I think a lot of Republicans are frustrated by what they see as an excessive caution in the Biden administration and a worry about escalation. A desire from Republicans for Biden to hit back more. And so how does that apply in different places? Well, in Israel, I think that, and this isn't in the book, this is just me, the peace through strength is in the book. But now on Israel, President Trump has said that Israel needs to finish the job. I think he's right about that. You can't fight 80% of a fire, you've got to put the fire out. Israel should go after Hamas, just like Trump went after ISIS on the battlefield in Iraq and Syria. On Ukraine, I think Dan and I agree on this, and this is the example that many people put forward is where the party is deeply divided. But here there actually is more agreement than people may understand. One, I think there's an agreement that under the Biden administration, the United States failed to deter Russia, that Russia attacked Georgia under George W. Bush. Russia attacked Ukraine the first time under Obama. No attacks during the Trump administration, and then re-attacked Ukraine under Biden. And Trump says that this wouldn't have happened if he were president. Second, I think there's a frustration on the part of Republicans that the Biden administration hasn't yet articulated a clear strategy. Biden says we'll fight as long as it takes or support Ukraine as long as it takes. But as long as it takes to do what? What are we trying to do? What's his plan for getting there? And so I think there's a sense among Republicans, no, we want a decisive end of the conflict, not to spend billions of dollars in years just to end an unsatisfactory outcome. And then I'd say the strategy debate among Republicans, on one hand, you have what could be called the Reaganite wing, who essentially say, give Ukraine everything they need to win on the battlefield decisively. And then on the other hand, you have maybe the Trumpian wing, and President Trump has said we'll end the war in 24 hours. And I think that's not literal, but take it seriously, not literally. He means to end it quickly. Yeah, my own view on this has changed. I was in the Reagan camp 2 years ago, but I think we're in a different place on this issue. But I think we're in a different place now. The Biden administration didn't give Ukraine everything it needed to win decisively. Over the past 2 years, that's given Russia time to dig in behind dragon's teeth and other things. New technology like drones seems to favor the defense. So it seems unlikely that either side is going to make major gains in offensive operations anytime soon. And so Steve Hadley and I, former National Security Advisor, wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal a month or so ago, arguing that Ukraine should switch to the defense. We should put pressure on Russia through other ways, including by providing Ukraine longer range weapons. That could create the conditions to wind the conflict down along the current line of contact, not leading to a peace agreement, but to a reduction of the violence that would give Ukraine breathing space, could create the conditions then for security guarantees, maybe even EU and NATO membership. And then like we did with West Germany during the Cold War, over time, through diplomacy and other things, help Ukraine
reclaim all of its international territory. And so Mr. Hadley and I argued that we think that's the best way forward, given where we are now. And I don't think there's anything in that strategy that's inconsistent with what Trump has said in terms of wanting to end the war quickly. But Dan, anything you'd like to add?
No, perfect.
Well, excellent. Well, thank you very much, both of you, for joining us. Thank you all to our audience for tuning in. The book is We Win, They Lose, Republican Foreign Policy and the New Cold War, out now. So go find it on Amazon, your local bookstore, wherever books are told. Dan, Matt, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Sam. Great to be here.
Yes, thanks very much, Sam. And thanks for the great work you and the Vandenberg Coalition are doing.
All right. Have a great afternoon, everyone.